This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Letting Trump be Trump. I'm Jennifer Kashinka, in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Here's what we have for you this hour. President Trump has surrounded himself with a small group of men who have decided to stand back and let him do his thing. We'll tell you who they are. Some surgery in your future, what you should know about anesthesia before undergoing the knife. Competing with your spouse, why you do it, and how it could hurt your relationship. And why you should do a two-minute checkup on your financial health.
Most of us know, to at least some degree, what we ought to do with our money. We ought to keep our debts low. We ought to save regularly. You know, we should spend less than we earn. We all know these things. The real problem is getting ourselves to do it.
Jonathan Clements of HumbleDollar.com will be here later in the hour with that story. After months of turnover and tumult in the White House, things seem to be settling down as President Trump surrounds himself with a group of men who are much like him. Jerry Tsai, Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal, has written a piece about Trump's contemporaries and joins us now. Jerry, who exactly is in the innermost circle right now?
I think you could make a case that the most important people around the president are John Kelly, his chief of staff, John Bolton, his national security advisor, Larry Kudlow, his National Economic Council head, and Rudy Giuliani, who's not in the White House, but his outside legal counsel, but the man who's increasingly taking the lead in his conversations about the Robert Mueller special counsel probe on Russian involvement in 2016's campaign. And if you look at And that's a fairly recent assemblage of people. And if you look at them, and it does appear that the president is comfortable with them, you have four men who are like the president in age. He's 72. The ages of Kelly, Bolton, Kudlow, and Giuliani, respectively, are 68, 69, 70, and 74. So they're kind of contemporaries of his, both in terms of age and life experience. Not young men on the rise, but people kind of at the end of their career arc, so they don't have as much to prove. And they seem content as a group to let Trump be Trump, not to try to control him. And he, in return, seems comfortable with them. So while there are a lot of things that agitate the president, the team around him seems to be one thing he's now, and maybe for the first time since he's been president, really comfortable with.
Jerry, how has this staff differ from past staffs in the White House?
Well, you know, I think you had previously people who did try to kind of control Donald Trump to some extent. And I think one thing that we've all learned from watching is that he's not to be controlled. I mean, he is going to do what he's going to do. He is going to be Trump. And I think even John Kelly, his chief of staff, has gone through over the last year or so a kind of a metamorphosis on that front. He's gone from trying to control access to the president to determining who he's going to talk to and who he's not going to talk to, and maybe even attempting to control his Twitter habit. And I think he's abandoned all those things, and he's basically not trying to control Donald Trump, but to kind of channel his impulses and to worry about managing the staff below him, not the president above him. And so I think that's the overall lesson of the way the Trump White House works. And I think it should be noted, this is a significant, maybe even a radical change from the way White Houses normally work. To have a weak chief of staff in a decentralized system is unusual and hasn't worked out well in the past, but you have a president who kind of wants to be his own chief of staff, his own communications director, his own press secretary to some extent. And so he now has people around him who've kind of stepped aside and let him do that.
We're speaking with Jerry Tsai, Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. There were reports, Jerry, very recently, that John Kelly was on his way out. Is that still true?
Well, that appears to not be true, and that's one of the reasons that I've been thinking about this and wrote about it this week, is that the The most immediate development on this front came last week when we at the Journal broke the story that the president had told John Kelly, and John Kelly in turn told the White House staff, that he, John Kelly, could stay around in his job through the 2020 election. And the president basically blessed that idea. Now, there are a lot of people, who, including me, frankly, who are skeptical he'll actually be around that long. It's a long time to serve in the chief of staff's job, but particularly for President Trump, who kind of burns people out. And there is some thought that the president will eventually want somebody who's more of a political character in that job than John Kelly, a retired general, is, because he'll be heading soon into a 2020 reelection season. But nonetheless, it was kind of a sign that John Kelly has survived and is surviving. And as I said, I think that's at least true in part because of the way he has changed the way he's doing the job, and the fact that he has stepped back and has kind of given up really trying to control or structure the world around Donald Trump too much.
Jerry, are those other men also putting away some of their own feelings or their own stances on certain subjects to support the president?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about John Bolton and Larry Kudlow, is that they do seem to be doing exactly that. I mean, they are implementing Trump policies that are at odds with what they seem to believe, or at least what they used to profess earlier in their careers. You know, John Bolton's been a hardliner on Russia for years, if not decades, and has been very acerbic in his criticism of North Korea, yet he is busy helping the president implement policies in which he's working very hard to have a better relationship with Russia and to kind of make nice with the North Koreans in a diplomatic process. And Larry Kudlow is a traditional economic conservative who has long been a free trader and suspicious of tariffs, yet he's busy both helping implement and making the argument publicly for a policy that leans heavily on tariffs as a way to change the way the world trade system works.
Jerry Seib, Washington editor at The Wall Street Journal. It's 13 minutes after the hour. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Scheduled for an operation, you might want to do a little more research on anesthesia before going under. Dr. Baron Metz of Penn State University, author of Waking Up Safer, an Anesthesiologist's Record, joins us now to educate us about medically induced comas. Dr. Metz, what physically happens to your body when you undergo anesthesia?
You know, I wrote the book, Waking Up Safer, to explain anesthesia to the layperson. You'd be surprised to know that the average American will suffer or have six anesthetics in a lifetime, six anesthetics, and most believe that it's sleep that they're going to undergo. It's not sleep at all. It's, in fact, chemically induced coma. So with chemically induced coma, we're introducing a whole list of drugs to try and depress consciousness so that you cannot remember any of the pain or the happenings that happen in the operating room.
Wow. How much have the drugs changed over the years?
Dramatically. And they've changed dramatically since the last 170 years when the first anesthetic, ether, was used. And I describe, of course, this story in the book as well, with William Morton giving the first anesthetic. We've progressed because of progress in drugs, equipment, and, of course, monitoring. And now, particularly, we borrowed from aviation to enhance safety. And so I tell a number of aviation stories, having been a pilot, or at least trained to be a pilot. And it's very much, giving anesthesia is very much like flying a plane. But we are not as safe as aviation is yet, and we are unlikely to be as safe as aviation will be in the future.
Why is that?
Well, it is because there's so much interpatient individuality variation. And, of course, patients are a lot more complex than planes, surprisingly. They are far more complex. There's far more variation and variability if a patient is sick. And so as a result of that, we have to try and manage their sickness while at the same time allowing them to live through an operation. So I call anesthesia really a balance between life and death, a life-giving surgery, and the fact that we are using lethal drugs that in under any other circumstance would surely kill the patient. But of course, we're trained to manage and to resuscitate that. So just to answer your question again, what really happens under anesthesia, we depress the brain and we depress most other vital systems as well. So your heart slows, your blood pressure drops, your respiration slows and stops. And, of course, your airway can collapse. And this is particularly a problem that we need to address urgently, because lack of oxygen to the brain is a very difficult situation to manage. And we only have around 4 minutes to assure that.
We are speaking with Dr. Baron Metz of Penn State University. That all sounds a little bit scary. Can patients have bad reactions? How common is that?
Well, it is a little bit scary, and that's why people are extremely well trained to manage it. Patients can, of course, survive. I mean, we do extremely well. Anesthesia safety over the last 60 years has improved 90-fold as a result of all the things that I already described. The problem is that it is inherently unsafe as a result of the fact that we have to induce this chemically induced coma. Now, we want to be 100% sure that the patients do not remember anything after the operation, so that's why we have to adjust the anesthetic. So giving anesthetic is a little bit like cooking. You know, when you cook, you add a few ingredients here, a few ingredients there, and every anesthesiologist does it slightly differently to ultimately reach that state of anesthesia that is appropriate for that patient for that type of surgery and allowing them to recover effectively after that.
I was going to say, if you're undergoing some kind of an operation without freaking yourself out, should you do some kind of research? What should you do before you go in?
Well, you know, one of the things you want to do is you want to be well prepared. You know, knowledge is power, and that's why I wrote this book. Another thing you always want to ask your anesthesiologist is the place you're working in safe? Do you have all the bells and whistles to have, for example, an emergency malignant hypothermia cart? This is when anesthetics cause a very high temperature. This is a problem, rare today, but we still need to be able to manage it. You want to ask the anesthesiologist, what's my plan for pain management postoperatively? And thirdly, you want to ask the anesthesiologist, are you going to give me some extra medications to minimize postoperative nausea and vomiting, which is a big problem for patients?
That's Dr. Baron Metz of Penn State University, author of Waking Up Safer. You can get more information on the doctor's website, baronmetz.com. That's BERENDMETS.com. It's 21 minutes after the hour. Coming up, why you can't stop competing with your spouse. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Couples are supposed to operate as a team, but sometimes they compete instead. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal has studied this phenomenon and is here now with more. Elizabeth, what kind of competition are we talking about?
Well, it can be anything, really. Couples, often spouses will compete over things in the home, parenting, cleaning, even, you know, working out's a big one for, you know, two type A people, who has more friends, who's closer to their family. But the really big one is work. Couples will compete over, you know, their careers. And what's happening is careers, work, they have very specific measures of success. You get raises and promotions and awards and accolades. And those things are, you know, often hard to ignore if it's something that you want to.
Elizabeth, you mentioned personality type A's. Is it usually two type A's, or is it all kinds of people that are competing?
Well, it can be all kinds of people, but type A's tend to be a little bit more strident and, competitive. And also the thing about work, too, is many couples meet either in grad school or in the office. You know, once you're an adult, like the places you might meet your friends and your future partner are often work-related. So you're already in similar fields. You may be similarly motivated. And sure, personality is something that influences competitive. Competition as well.
Elizabeth, what is the underlying reason for all this?
Well, the underlying reason we don't want to hear, but it's envy. So we're envious, which is it's different than jealousy. So envy is when we want something that someone else has, period. We can't have it, at least not right now. Jealousy has a third person involved. Often we're worried we're going to lose someone to a third person or we're going to lose something to a third person. It's more triangular. So it's envy is at work here in this competition.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. What are some of the solutions for this problem?
Well, it's very hard to speak about envy to anyone, but especially, you know, your spouse. So you're going to want to try to speak to it. The reason it's hard is, you know, to say I'm envious of your, you know, big award is to say I feel inferior. You know, so you're going to have to try to find a way to open up. Often the spouse who's the envied can say, hey, you know, what's going on here? Things are, you know, a little tense. You know, what's happening? So you want to talk about it and be open about it, because when envy festers, it creates resentment, and that's a horrible thing in a marriage.
And it seems like it always comes down to communication in any problem, right?
Sadly, it does, because, you know, we're often very hard at it. But the more intense the feelings, the closer we are to the person, the higher the stakes then, right, on, you know, this communication. So, yeah, but it comes down to communicating, and the couples that do well across the board are communicating.
Elizabeth, how can you appreciate your partner rather than be envious?
So two things. When you're the envied partner, you want to appreciate that support and realize, you know, like, I might be feeling great about myself. I got this promotion, and you know, everybody at work thinks I'm fantastic, but, you know, I didn't get there alone. Someone's home, you know, helped pull in a little bit more slack, maybe, you know, driving the kids to soccer, whatever it is. So you want to appreciate, make sure your spouse knows, that the envious spouse knows that they're appreciated, you know, so you want to make sure you're showing that and giving reassurance. You know, look, I know, you know, you might not be, you know, feeling like you're shining right now, but you're going to do it. You know, you're this is great. You know, I love you just the way you are. So, you know, those are two things that the envied person wants to keep showing to the envious person.
Elizabeth, for your story, I know you talked to a couple of couples. How did they actually put these things into work?
So one of the big things that the research suggests is that you should choose different things that you may be good at. And that's what these couples naturally did. It's what the research shows you should do, but they just sort of did it. They naturally differentiated. So even in the home, you know, I might be good at math, I'm good at budgeting. You know, my partner is, you know, better at maybe organizing our day or where we're going to go on vacation. So they just looked for different areas to shine. Even if they're in different fields, they looked at different areas to shine in.
Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Coming up this half hour, why you should do a two-minute checkup on your financial health. The shame of throwing liquid bacon grease down the drain, who's doing it and who's getting caught, and the modern way that churches are taking your donations. That story in about 20 minutes. This business update is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. If you work at a company like Google or Facebook, you love the free food. But if you own one of the local restaurants in the surrounding community, you're not too happy. Tech expert Rob Enderle is here to talk about tech company culture. Rob, how does the culture at certain Silicon Valley tech companies affect their neighbors?
A lot of these companies really want you to stay in the company, not go anyplace. They want you working all the time and kind of playing and eating together, which is one of the reasons they put in cafeterias. Some of them, like Oracle, for instance, have things like cleaners, child care, bakeries, you name it. You can pretty much get it done without ever leaving the Oracle campus. But the problem, of course, for local vendors is you're buying stuff in the company and you're not buying stuff at the local restaurants or vendors. And given the cities are giving these firms subsidies to go into their area, I think they've found, or at least they believe, that taking business away from local businesses is counterproductive.
When they have daycare and some of the services inside the campus, does that not create jobs for the people of the town?
It does. I mean, the reality is the people that work inside the company, regardless of what they're doing, are often citizens. Though I should point out, a lot of places where these folks are building, housing prices are so high that the folks that are working as waiters or service personnel can't afford to live in the city in any case, which is why a lot of people pointed out that maybe the city should be focused on providing affordable housing rather, because that's much harder. One of the things that's much harder to do, but it'd be much better for the city, as opposed to restricting the firms from having food on campus. It just, by doing the food on campus thing, there's very low risk to the government, and it looks good.
Will there be pushback of companies not being allowed then to have free food at their offices?
Well, it's going to make the cities less attractive. The difficulty is these campuses, a lot of these campuses house thousands upon thousands of people, and getting them on and off the campus can be problematic. They've got to do that twice a day when the firm opens and closes, but doing it again at lunch really does become problematic. And a lot of these firms do meetings in the cafeteria as well, and so it denies them that access, and now they're going to have to go off campus for some of the lunch meetings where they weren't otherwise. And of course, we've seen problems where folks have gone off campus. They've gone to inappropriate places like strip clubs, which the companies were trying to restrict, particularly in this Me Too world. So this is going against traffic. It's going against some of the bad behavior these firms were trying to correct. So all in all, I think this is probably very short-sighted. The reality is that what it's going to do is going to force companies to going towards more of an arcology model, which means people live, work, eat, go to school on the campus, and then they take the entire campus and they put it someplace else. That's been the trend a lot of us were expecting to kick off, and this kind of behavior will likely promote that trend.
We're speaking with tech expert Rob Enderle. You touched on it earlier, the housing issue. That is a huge one. There was a struggle around Amazon in Seattle. Housing is just so expensive. Is there anything that the companies can do about that?
Well, as I say, they can move to an arcology model, which means they build housing right on the campus. A lot of us thought that's what Apple should have done when they did the Flying Saucer campus in Mountain View, because housing was just so incredibly expensive and traffic was already so incredibly bad that you couldn't get to and from the building. And I know when they were building that building, even then you couldn't actually get to the building and the traffic was so bad. So then now that they're starting to populate that building, it's got to be horrendous. It's really thinking through the traffic and the living conditions is the bigger issue, but it's a far harder issue to address because that means you're asking people to build housing for lower income families, which is not as lucrative, particularly when you've got, you know, people with a ton of money willing to pay pretty much anything for a shack in those areas.
Tech expert Rob Enderle. It's 21 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Do you need a two-minute checkup? That's a tool designed to provide a quick initial assessment of your finances. Joining us now to tell us how it works is Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com and a former personal finance columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, why do we need such a checkup?
The checkup grew out of a project I've been working on for a couple of years, and the key notion behind it is this. Most of us know, to at least some degree, what we ought to be doing with our money. We ought to keep our debts low. We ought to save regularly. You know, we should spend less than we earn. And we all know these things. The real problem is getting ourselves to do it. And so in designing the two-minute checkup, what it is part of a larger project to have a site that helps people figure out what they need to do with their money and then gets them to do it. And the two-minute checkup is designed to be that initial financial assessment. All we ask from people is 9 pieces of financial information, things you should know off the top of your head, you know, what your annual income is, you know, how old you are, how much debt you have. And if you tell us these 9 pieces of information, we can then analyze your finances across 10 areas of your financial life. And you might say to yourself, well, how could you possibly do that? Well, the fact is, you know, a lot of personal finance comes down to very simple rules. You know, for instance, one of my favorite rules is that you should try to keep your fixed living costs. We're talking about things like mortgage or rent, the insurance premiums you pay, grocery bills, car payments. You try to keep these fixed living costs to 50% or less of your pre-tax monthly income. If you do that, then you're going to have plenty of extra money each month to save, and that means that you'll be in better financial shape over the long haul.
Jonathan, do you think we really sit down and analyze how much we're spending?
No, and I don't think most people really need to. There's a lot of people out there who say, oh, it's so important to have a budget. I've never budgeted in my entire life. Instead, what's important is making sure that you save enough each month. If you're saving, say, 12% of income each month, preferably in your company's 401k plan. If you don't have a 401k plan, then maybe you have an IRA. If you're saving that 12% of income every month, it doesn't really matter how you spend the rest of the money, as long as you're not going into ever more debt to support your lifestyle, as long as you're living within the remaining money, then you're doing just fine.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com and a former personal finance columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, you talk about property taxes. Do we understand how that factors into what we have and what we need to save?
When you go to get a mortgage, what the bank is going to do is they're going to say, all right, whatever house you buy, the monthly mortgage payment shouldn't be more than 28% of your pre-tax monthly income. 28% of your pre-tax monthly income going towards that mortgage payment. But the mortgage payment is not just the principal and interest payments you have to make each month. Included in that monthly mortgage payment is your homeowner's insurance and, for most people, the really big number, is their property taxes. So when you look across the country at how much people are paying in homeowner's insurance and how much they're paying in property taxes, it turns out that they can borrow far less than they imagined to buy their dream home. So if you take that 28% of pre-tax monthly income that should be going towards your mortgage payment, typically around 6% of that is going towards homeowner's insurance and property taxes, which means that the principal and interest part of that payment could only be 22% of your pre-tax monthly income. The net result, you can't buy quite as big a house as you had hoped.
Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com and a former personal finance columnist at the Wall Street Journal. It's 13 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Ever pour the liquid bacon grease down the drain? Apparently a lot of people do, even knowing they shouldn't. Laura Cody of the Wall Street Journal has written a story entitled, Everyone Pours Bacon Fat Down the Drain, Everyone Lies About It. Laura, who did you talk to for your story?
Well, I talked to a lot of just everyday people who I actually found online who admitted to kind of covertly dumping this bacon fat down the drain. So it wasn't anybody special. It's kind of just your average everyday American who does this.
And what kinds of problems did they have after pouring grease down the drain?
Well, you know, the people I talked to were actually lucky enough not to have any problems, but it can get pretty bad. One of the women I talked to, her roommates actually were doing it a lot, and it basically created a 3-foot-long fat blockage in her drain. It can cause really bad plumbing problems. You usually have to get somebody in with a machine to scrape it out. You know, Drano won't fix this type of thing, and so it can get really expensive really fast and flood your house, honestly.
Laura, what did people not understand about sending liquid bacon grease down the drain?
People don't quite get that when you pour the bacon grease down the drain, it becomes solid. Usually it hardens like candle wax, but if you do it over time, it can get really solid, like a block of hard, dry soap. The plumbers that I talk to, you know, basically talk about it. If it's been down there long enough, it can get like concrete. So it might start out liquid, but it does not stay liquid.
We're speaking with Laura Cordy of the Wall Street Journal. Now, I can see where homeowners wouldn't necessarily have a problem with this, but I think you spoke to some people who worked in restaurants. This has to be a huge problem.
It is, and you know, most restaurant workers know better. I did talk to one woman who didn't quite understand what was going to happen. I think that she had just never, you know, poured bacon grease down the drain or seen anybody else do it. She didn't really think it was a problem. But restaurants, actually, most of them have these grease traps, which have to be cleaned out regularly. Grease traps that catch, you know, everything that's coming down from the dishwashers. And so it's a huge deal for restaurants, and they usually have a pretty good way of dealing with it. But like you might have read, you know, that's not a fail-safe. Sometimes stuff does get through and it does clog the drains.
Laura, the people you talked to, did they admit it when they threw stuff down the drain they shouldn't have?
You know, the key to getting this was finding the spouses of the people who did this, because it's usually the spouses who know better and complain. So I talked to, well, I actually found one man who on Twitter, you know, wrote that, the wife's away, it's time to pour bacon grease down the drain. So I was, you know, I was able to talk to him, and he said, you know, he knows better, but sometimes if it's a little bit, he'll still do it. And I talked to his wife, who actually does this for a living, overseeing water waste system repairs. So she's been there when they dig up the pipes and they see, you know, the grease clogged up in the drains. So when her husband was about to pour it down, pour the bacon grease down the drain, she stopped him and kind of freaked out. So that's kind of, you know, they do admit to it after a while, but, you know, everybody I talked to had a good sense of humor about it.
Laura Cody of the Wall Street Journal. It's 6 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Coming up, new ways churches are collecting your tithes. Don't carry cash? Don't worry, your church will take your donation another way. The New York Post notes that thousands of Christian churches across the world are now using portable card readers or apps to take donations. The Church of England says 16,000 religious sites now have access to portable card readers. In the U.S., hundreds of churches have installed kiosks where the faithful can swipe a card to donate. Others are popularizing smartphone apps where money can be sent over at any time. The technologies vary from donations via website to apps and physical screens set up at the church. The contactless card reader, which can be passed around the pews like the traditional offering plate, is a newer evolution that the Church of England in particular has been adopting. Contactless payment companies iZettle and SumUp have created a system that religious sites can install. It takes Apple Pay and Google Pay, but also can be used with a PIN code if needed. The innovation seems to be yielding good results. A startup that makes donation apps for churches in France says the average contribution is 2 to 6 times higher than cash donations. And that'll do it for this hour. For Gordon Deal, I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.